Good afternoon. Yes, my name is Alison Hutton. To my left is Patty Baxter. We're appearing on behalf of John Waterston. Mr. Waterston is out in the audience today if you do have any questions for him as well. I haven't prepared a summary of evidence given that my evidence was reasonably brief and I have the experience and qualifications that are outlined in my evidence and Appendix A. I'm happy to take you through, if you like, paragraph 11 of my evidence, which summarises the reasons in which we think that, or the submission in terms of moving the line for development of that area is moved, and I can go through that if that works for you, or just answer any questions, whatever is the quickest.
We've all read this evidence, yeah, so it's probably easiest. We'll just go straight to questions because I've got a question on subject of the party. You refer to a right of way, and does the right of way cut across the farm or is it needed to access the land?
It's needed to access the land, but I haven't been on site, but I can check with Mr. Wilson to verify that if need be.
That's just unclear.
Yeah.
The rationale is that.
There is that potential lot is served or does need to go over that right of way to get into that no build area, which is effectively farmed at the moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the other question I have for you was you referred to an environmental decision, but you and Mr. Baxter, I think, referred to the same decision, but you haven't told us what it is.
We can get that information.
Yeah, and those are what's known as the Waterston decisions, and there are, I think, two interim decisions and one final decision, and they were to the operative district plan.
And they were zoning decisions?
Yes, they were. No, they were zoning conditions. They effectively created a sub-zone within the rural living zone in the operative plan.
Yes. Just got one question. On this point of the area being effectively landlocked for farming purposes,
yes.
Is it a result of the development that's been approved to date, or is it a longer standing situation? So what has caused it to be landlocked?
I think it is caused as a result of development to date in the area, but I can. There is the other access down along Tucker Beach Road before you get into what was known as sort of Waterston subzone, which is these areas in, with the green building platforms on the map attached to Mr. Baxter's evidence.
I only had one question, and it may be a question that Mr. Baxter needs to answer, but I'll throw it on the table. I did go and find the environmental court decision. As you say, the fact that Mr. Waterston's name all over helps. The court said that in its opinion, further development of the site subject of application should be precluded. Does that mean that the no build zones are the wrong place? And it doesn't achieve what the court set out to achieve?
I think that's definitely a Mr. Baxter question.
I think the intention was the preclusion of future development within the no build area, but I mean, that's what I recall from the outcome of the court case.
Just that I read the sequence and it was an initial decision and then a direction to go and come up with a plan.
Yep.
and the statement that there should be no more development permitted was in the initial decision. So hence my question, is the problem that the plan did not achieve what the court intended?
The court in the second hearing accepted the advice of Anne Stevens where the no build line should be on the hill, and it didn't require, at the advice based on her evidence, for the no build line to be lower than where it's shown there. So I think if you refer to, we may be able to find it, the advice of Anne Stevens, which was set up that line, and the court accepted her evidence.
So I only have one other question. That's clearly for Mr. Baxter, but you should probably pick up anything that Commissioner Smith has.
Yes.
No,
I'm okay.
There you go.
I don't have anything else for Mr. Baxter.
The question for you, for me, Mr. Baxter, is you've discussed the evidence to support the plan. What I'm interested in is what the appearance of this development, if it proceeds, will be from any relevant viewing points that we should know about.
Most relevant viewing points will be to Main Road, sir, and from Middles Road, which are at considerable distance. So what we have here is the existing house on Lot 2. The proposed residential building platform, RBP2, is the same elevation as that, and RBP1 is slightly lower than that. So from those views, we're not increasing, we're not creeping up the hill. And we do have houses around the other side of a similar elevation, around to the east. Having said that, the design controls that I've recommended on here have recommended that there's probably more consistency in the architecture that goes up there, and that's why the controls I've got here are fairly tight in terms of 4.5 metres and dark recessive colours, no plaster, so that we get an outcome which is similar to the dwelling that was up there already. I thought that was important because it's on the edge of the base of the hill, and I thought it would be inappropriate to have a mix of colours and claddings which has come out along the bottom of Tucker Beach Road. So it's an approach which I consistently advocate in terms of keeping a consistent outcome in terms of the building amenity. So I've probably digressed there. That has a lot to do with the views that you'll get. There's a little section of Littles Road, sir, and there's Domain Road. I can't recall the distances, but they're 1.5 to 2 kilometres away.
I actually cruised around trying to see where I could see that site from.
Mm.
How far along Domain Road would you need to go?
Oh, right up towards, close towards the north end of Domain Road, closer towards, on the south end, it's tucked around the corner, but the top half of Domain Road. So, yeah, I'm closer towards the spare grass, the top half being that half on the, towards the spare grass Delfield Road intersection, on that top end.
Rapid
130
onwards, probably.
Yeah,
well. I don't know the area that well.
I don't have that degree of accuracy.
Today you
put
coffee
at 1:30. Yeah, so and then you'll find that there's a couple of glimpses from Littles Road, but that's a considerable distance away.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baxter.
That's all right. Thank you.
good news and bad news.
Right.
We received your legal submissions in advance, but when we received them, it was 10 o'clock this morning.
Ah, right. Sorry, then we were lodged on Friday afternoon, I apologise.
Yes, unfortunately, it was after Miss Marston had left.
Oh, right, fair enough.
So we have, some of us have read more than others.
Yeah.
So it may take us through.
Okay. Well, to relieve you a little bit, some sections of the submissions are very familiar to Ms. Hill's submissions that you've seen previously. So where I know that we're using the same case law for obvious reasons, I won't go over that. And otherwise, I'll spend a little bit more time on where there are some new bits or points that I just personally want to emphasise for the purpose of these two clients. And so just to confirm, we are the last, not that I'm going to drag out your day unnecessarily, but we are the last people up, so we don't need to feel guilty about the people behind us.
Right. We haven't felt guilty about the people behind us so far.
No, you've got to find out what you need to find out. Yeah. Well, I won't belabour who the submitter entities are. Just one thing I have noted in the legal submissions, and I'll just repeat, is that whilst the submissions from the Derby entities critiqued the land use study for the purpose of this hearing, in order to be constructive and help find a solution, we're putting that critique to one side and focusing on trying to get outcomes that we think are more appropriate than what was notified. So just say that for the record. There are, in terms of the relevance of the existing environment at the start of those submissions, I do set out the existing consents for two of the submitter entities, Lake Hayes Limited and Lake Hayes Cellar, which you might otherwise know as the Emmersfield site. So Lake Hayes Limited has got an existing subdivision consent yet to be implemented. And as you know, Emmersfield is an operating cellar door wine tasting and bistro, and has various consents to do with that. So they become relevant later on in the submissions when you talk about the relevance of that existing environment to a certain extent. And I've set out on page 2, but I don't propose you need to read it now, just an extract from the decision on the Lake Hayes Limited subdivision in particular, which just captures, in terms of the theme of appropriate development in the precinct in particular, captures an example of a decision made under the operative framework and that control activity subdivision status that still illustrated that there was considered to be good control to enable a quality outcome, but still in that control activity framework.
I just question, who was it who considered that? Who gave it their considered opinion?
Was it
one of the regulatory planners? Or was it a hearing commissioner?
Oh, you're probably off, don't you? Hang on, I've got the decision.
May well have been Mr. Fields.
I don't have the decision.
I'm in the body playing nature. One of the decisions it was.
Then, yeah.
Obviously, a brilliant decision.
Well conceived to you. Well, that's in terms of the consents, but I think the zoning, the history of the zoning goes back a bit.
No, well, it's the consent. And that's the consent that's been quoted.
Yeah. We can find out for you.
Just goes to the
way. Yeah, not fair enough. I mean, I doubt it was not even notified, wasn't it? In that case, was it subdivision?
Well, no, it was control activity. Yeah. Provisions of control activity.
So the next, page 2 and 3, I just describe what's happening on the Emmersfield site, but just to confirm, you would have undertaken a site visit there and possibly are personally familiar with the activities on that site, so I won't belabour that. Mm-hmm.
The brief
goes
stations.
What was that?
The Brief Those Station site, just remind me where that is.
That's up on the Crown Terrace.
Right.
So it's outside of the basin boundary,
yes.
But it's basically on the boundary looking in,
yes.
Hence its interest in why, that's the comment that was made in the submissions.
I think it's one of those ones where we haven't made the decision on the rural zone.
That's exactly right.
Of course,
right.
It was
partly
within, partly caught by this.
Yeah, that's right. From page 4 onwards, that's something, a point that Ms. Hill would have made to you before in terms of
what's a Section 7 landscape, and that we've got the quote there from the Wesley case referring to that cloak of human activity being much more obvious in this Section 7 type landscape. So you'll be familiar with that. And under the heading Legal Issues on page 5, we just give you a product summary of what we submitted in stage 1 about making district plans that's relevant to your decision making. And again, those are cases that we've cited previously for other submitters in this hearing stage, so I won't belabor those.
Mate, I wonder if you could help me on your D. Ms Hill cited Serebus' decision to us, and yes, I've read it. I understood the point she was making in the Ladies' Mile context. But you seem to be saying that a plan can never have a directive planning purpose.
Yeah, it's definitely a different context to Ladies' Mile, which was the exclusion of most of the Ladies' Mile land from this plan altogether for that quite ulterior purpose of encouraging the SHA route. So we're not in that realm when I reference it in this context. It's Serebus case is less relevant to the Amersfield site in particular, which is the main submitter that this submission about Serebus is in respect of. It's more about that theme of ensuring that the existing and consented environment is very live to your decision making as a relevant factor, and not putting a zoning around it that ends up with the existing activity being incongruous with the zoning that gets put upon it. So it's more along those lines. So I accept that Serebus is kind of not centrally on that point.
There wasn't a distinction in Serebus that Serebus, as I understand it, they had an industrial zoning.
That's right.
And it was taken away from them.
That's right, yes.
They case Summer.
Does not have a commercial tourism zone.
Rural and
lifestyle
zone.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So in a sense, there hasn't really been much change to it, in the sense of the effects on that activity itself.
It's both site specific, and then even if you just go a little bit to either side of Amersfield, it's definitely becoming more restrictive under the framework as notifiable variation. So the BRAS, which is what Amersfield would sit in, is more of a much more protective zoning. And then if they actually lose that one adjacent, is it the rural residential on the hill that's adjacent to it, across the road on one side of the triangle, but they get to keep the low density zoning, I think, sort of remains around the lake. So half its wider context might remain, but half of it might also turn into BRAS if it proceeds as notified, even though I know those residents are opposed to that. So it's really that full package of changing the existing environment from one that sits a bit more comfortably within to one that it sticks a bit out of a sore thumb a bit more.
The other distinguishing factor in Serebus was that the court found there was no evidence that the educational institutions actually wanted that land, and so effectively the council fell on its face.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So they were taking away the industrial zone and substituting something that the potential users of that zone
didn't want. Yeah, that's right. It did go much. It was much more sort of very fact specific, that case. So I agree. My point E about choosing the less restrictive option is being, when you're looking at what's most appropriate to give effect to objectives, or for objectives to give effect to higher order instruments, that's a key and consistent concern that we've got, is that the least restrictive option to give effect to those appropriate higher order provisions is not what's currently being advocated for by the council. So I just want to draw your attention to that that point. And that will come in again, and as you know, the regional policy statement has been a moving feast and is about to stop moving, which is really good. And ideally, we'll get that last set of consent orders before before possibly you close this hearing, and I understand there's been iterative conversation about how process-wise it's best to deal with that once we've actually got an actually new, brand new operative RPS.
I've just been a couple of minutes thinking about that over the weekend.
A couple of minutes, yeah. Yeah, so
it's not that easy to solve that issue right at the moment. But
no,
the
it's
interesting
not.
Thing is that most people who have turned up have actually made submissions on the conceit orders that have been
written
already and the ones that have been lodged.
Yeah.
So, in fact,
you've got all the information
to date, no one has been disadvantaged.
Yeah. Well, if you think you've got all that information, that's probably all you need.
We'll see it being the week.
Yeah. But I don't think anyone has actually been in a position to not
comment on what's happened today.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So you might not
need
a separate process. No, not. But I guess where I'm coming from is if you look at if you decide that the most appropriate provisions to give effect to, say, the now settled RPS are ones that are the least restrictive to give effect to that RPS, then that, in my submission, that's quite a long way away from the position the council's advocating, which is more restrictive than what's required to give effect to the RPS.
Do we have that discretion? If the RPS, like for instance, later in your submissions, you're relying on the not quite the consent memoranda as they relate to amenity landscapes, which your submission is that that's a less restrictive test.
Yes.
Are we still giving effect to the RPS if we impose a more restrictive test? Obviously, we have to have an evidential basis for that.
Yes.
But are we giving effect to the RPS or not giving effect to the RPS? Or?
Well, I think on that, because there's that, I'll flip to it so I'm not making it up, there's that aspect of the policy. I've actually quoted it there, but it's in that policy set that talks about avoid, remedy, or mitigate. So the RPS, one of the RPS provisions in respect of non-outstanding landscapes is not just...
your paragraph 23.
Cool. I was looking for that. Oh, but there's a third one that I haven't written down, which is avoid, remedy, or mitigate.
Is the RPS one there?
Yeah, so 3.2.6b refers to avoid, remedy, or mitigate other adverse effects. So if you think about that in the context of section 7c, if that doesn't give you enough direction, because it's giving you the full range, avoid, remedy, or mitigate, so you know, choose anything, what's appropriate in this context to get more certainty, let's look at section 7c, about maintaining and enhancing amenity values, and that's where things, you know, get a bit more focused. What was the question, Commissioner? Sorry, I just went on a bit of a rant there.
The question was,
you created more.
If the RPS has a given level of restriction,
yes,
to Donald Trump, are we not giving effect to it?
Negative.
If we find a greater level of restriction is justified.
If you find based on...
I can always tell you I missed out a knot.
If you find that a greater level of restriction is justified, then the RPS will require it at a minimum, because that's what part two of the Act gives you the information to do, then that is inappropriate.
Inappropriate?
Thank you. Decision making process.
Well, possibly not.
Cerebos. We've talked about forest and bird case and the least restrictive option. And then I review some of the evidence that was presented in stage one. that underpins Mr. Ferguson's evidence in particular.
Can I ask a question about that? I was going to ask Mr. Ferguson, it's probably best put to you. Mr. Ferguson relies on the evidence that Ms. Fluger, he seems to be the evidence, he says that Ms. Fluger presented in respect of Lake Hayes Sellers Limited. That case was entirely set aside to be heard in this hearing, and we never heard her evidence on that. That part of her evidence, we never actually heard.
Oh, the actual part, yes. Because it was presented, it was written and
it was
submitted
written
to
one,
you.
Yes,
right.
But we never had, because at the commencement of Stream 2, we said, well, that's actually a rezoning issue that needs to be dealt with in the Waikato Basin rezoning.
Right.
And so we never actually dealt with that. And I suspect.
Good remembering. Well, right. Well,
yeah, we did deal with her general.
General,
evidence.
Yeah, because it was about chapter 6.
And that was what led
yeah.
to the,
yeah.
In large part, led to the minute seeking the state.
Yes. Right.
It's a
Vauxhall.
Yes.
So, does the panel have any questions for Ms. Fluger? Because we could make an arrangement.
Well, I hadn't even read it.
No, okay.
It wasn't until I read Mr. Ferguson.
Yeah.
I saw it
there.
Just think about how you deal with it.
No, I certainly haven't read it.
And the reason she's here is she is in Austria, which is why we chose the efficient route of referring to her priorly presented evidence. So, that is what it is. Let us have a wee think about that.
Yes.
There may not be much we can do about it.
We've still got 10 minutes. 10 minutes on Wednesday or Thursday afternoon if you want to
think about it,
this, how we can deal with it. And I'll say now that I've generally been saying no to Skype discussions.
Right,
and phone calls, it just doesn't work.
Yes.
She jumped on a plane, I think, today.
To Austria. She might be feeling that fresh anyway. Right, well, I mean, we'll review how much it actually adds to what the relief we're seeing.
It may not make a difference to Mr. Ferguson's evidence anyway, if it's not reliable.
That's true. So we'll look at it in that context. Then Section 7C, some of this you might not have seen much before because it is a bit of work we did later last week on some more case law about what amenity values are. Because I think that, my submission anyway, is pretty central to your decision making, is actually really grappling with what does maintain and enhance amenity values mean. It's definitely just more than a landscape question. And so what are the Waikato-based amenity values? So I just wanted to give, I guess, the panel a little bit of extra fuel about what various cases have said about the term amenity values and how wide that term is, and that it's a dynamic, evolving concept as society and the community's needs sort of change and grow, and what the community is appreciating about a place, and it could be a rural place, it could be an urban place. Amenity values are, you know, everywhere. So that's what this next section of the submissions are about.
Ms. Baker, I'm just reading the quote in paragraph 17.
Yeah.
It's the million-dollar question where we are in that continuum that the court is drawing between one level, more lifestyle blocks might increase naturalness, but there's a limit when too much subdivision leads to over-domestication. Are we at the stage where we're still improving things with more lifestyle, or are we on the door, or perhaps over the trigger of leading to over domestication?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think because it's, you know, it is quite an old case, and you could take from that case and move on and say, well, Section 7 isn't actually just about landscape, even though that's what that quote is mainly referencing. It's about a broader thing called amenity values, and is even using the word over domestication relevant to the consideration of amenity values. It depends how we define them in the first place for the Waikato Basin. So what are the amenity values that are currently important and that the community wants to maintain and enhance? And maintain could be done with a certain level of development, and enhance could be done with other development, you're still enhancing rural living, amenity values, or enhancing visitor tourism, that's plenty way of putting it, but, you know, you can still enhance those experiences and those amenity values by enabling, you know, well-managed development. So I think that paragraph is seems to be quite restricted to that landscape visual appreciation of amenity values rather than the broader options you've got when you look at amenity values.
So we've asked this question multiple lawyers and planners.
Mm.
Your interpretation of maintain and enhancement in relation to amenity values is that it's not a no development position, and that based on these cases, development might well be consistent with enhancement,
mm.
depending on the evidence.
That's right, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So do you give us any suggestions as to what other aspects of amenity values we should consider other than landscape? I'm quite interested in this because I have on occasion had it put to me as a planner that I had no ability to comment on amenity values.
Right.
Because I wasn't a landscape architect.
Oh, really? Okay, well, that's not correct. Yeah, I mean, well, it's about, it's a very anthropocentric term, amenity values, because it's about what people enjoy. I think you'll be thinking about not just residents, but visitors and what they're appreciating, what they're valuing. And it's obviously not just about landscape, because it's about use, it's about recreation, whether that's passive recreation, sitting in the sun, tasting wine, or active recreation as you're zooming around on your e-bike. So all of those experiential things that people value, they go far beyond landscape, so they can also go to noises and smells and air quality, and, you know, all of that contributes to how people enjoy the environment that they're in.
Does it go to elements of emptiness, as opposed to openness? Openness being a landscape term, but emptiness being lack of people.
Lack of people? Yes, absolutely. There's, and I haven't cited it here, but that's a good question. There's a little line of case law that I like to look at when we're talking about wild spaces, empty wild spaces, and that that's an aspect of amenity values for particular places.
Yeah, you can look at the quality of the building sometimes as well. So we have historically had a focus perhaps on hiding our architecture, and perhaps the landscape-driven regime might drive that outcome. But, you know, to me, I very much enjoy seeing really good architecture and really good buildings. Perhaps the Amsfield building itself might be a good example of that, which may not be possible if you had, you know, strict criteria around visibility, for example. Or the planting that might result from human occupation in a particular area. You know, you sort of look at the avenue of trees down Millbrook or something like that as an example.
Mm-hmm.
You think, well, that's a, it's an enhancement of sort of, you know, contributes to your appreciation of that, the amenity of that area.
Mm.
Traffic?
Mm. Yes.
Depends if it's moved or stopped.
Or if you're sitting in it.
Stops, it tends to be quiet and looking.
Yeah.
It's electric, so
it's okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I didn't find any.
Well, there isn't the case that you stated there. It does talk about increasing volume of heavy goods vehicles.
Right, well, yeah, in terms of the noise.
But if you've got an increase in traffic,
demand.
Would that be an effect on
amenity values?
The noise that would be generated from traffic would be an effect on amenity values.
The effect on school children going to the bus stops?
The frustration that comes from being stuck moving very slowly?
Yeah. So if you Yeah, if you look at the definition of amenity value strictly, just on page 8. I mean, amenity value is defined in the positive.
Mm.
It's the things that make it nice.
Yes. But things, other things can diminish the pleasantness.
The pleasantness.
Pleasantness of cruising down the highway.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't thinking that so much. But the pleasantness of walking along a country road might be diminished if there's a car every 1.5
yes,
seconds.
Yes, or riding a horse down the trail.
Mm.
Yeah. No, I think there's a theme to follow on that point. Yeah, exactly. Twice as many. Yeah. So that takes me through to really to page 11, that amenity values collection of cases. I mean, that, you know, that they all just explore it. None of them, I think, are definitive in terms of your decision making. But I was just, I think, conscious that we haven't presented those cases to you until we thought about them most recently, and I know that that's one of the things you're grappling with. So I put in what we can to be of assistance, really.
Before you move on to the next point, I know Ms. Hill's answer to this question. I want to know your answer, and that is, what is the difference between protection on the one hand and maintenance and enhancement on the other?
Yeah. So protection is avoid risk of harm. It's a very high threshold. Harm to a specific thing, and it's about harm. Whereas maintain and enhance is different. When you talk maintain and enhance amenity value, so yeah.
Maintain
is keep the same.
Just
maintain. See, I'll run them together because it's not maintain or enhance, is it? Or is it? Is it maintain and enhance? Okay.
It says
all.
It says all.
Right. Okay. Maintain is keep the same, which.
Doesn't matter what it is you're protecting or maintaining, given that this is amenity values. Does it make sense to talk about protecting amenity values from harm in any meaningful way?
Oh, I don't think it does it? Keep the same, I think, makes more sense when you're talking about amenity values than protect from harm. It's how do you harm an amenity value? It's not like not when you're talking about, you know, that protect term is usually used in the context of an ecosystem or a species or something that can be, you know, landscape even, that can be more objectively stated when it's been harmed, when it's been degraded.
Landscape being objectively stated?
Well, you know, from the landscape architect school of expertise, We rely on them to say whether or not a particular landscape has been protected from adverse effects and from inappropriate development.
Just come back to my original question, is there a difference? If you're talking in the context of amenity value, is there a difference, a material difference, between protecting amenity values and maintaining them?
Maintain them, protect, keep safe from harm.
But put it another way, could you say that if you wish to maintain something, one of the policy directions you might have is to protect something? But you might
maintain by protecting, or alternatively protect by maintaining?
Well, yes.
Are they interchangeable?
For some reason, I don't think they are, but I'm struggling to articulate why. But I'll think about that really hard overnight, I don't think they are the same. I'll just try and articulate for you appear again tomorrow, why? If that's where I land.
The suggestion has been made by other lawyers that it's a perception issue, which might explain why you're struggling to come up with a substantive difference.
Yeah.
We're seeing you again tomorrow, and you said Ms. Rob, aren't we?
Yes, me and Ms. Rob for Morven Ferry.
Yes, so you'll be able to answer
this question. Yes, hopefully, if I can, yes, I will. Yeah. Yes. We'll look into that. Page 12, I say, even though, and I flagged this at the start, whilst there's concern raised with the study and the submissions as lodged, we're putting that aside for now so that we can focus on being more productive in this context. And then I summarise from 26 onwards, page 12 onwards, the outcomes that we're seeking both for the precinct provisions, which is relevant to Lake Hayes Limited in particular, and then the Lake Hayes Stella site. Now, I don't propose to go through that because Mr. Ferguson's got a summary as well that he'll read out and remind us of those outcomes that we're seeking through changes to the provisions. But basically, for the precinct, it's about generally the vegetation rule, the setback rule, heights, and activity status of subdivision. That's what's primarily relevant for Lake Hayes Limited, whereas, as you know, for Lake Hayes Cellar, we're seeking, if it is to be BRAS, we're seeking a commercial overlay that more obviously contemplates the evolution and diversification of activities primarily on that site. And then I think page 18, the traffic submission, it's obviously a submission that you've heard quite consistently now from some of the submitters, which is that, to enable NZTA to do its business case, having a certainty of what's actually zoned is of assistance, and it is exactly that chicken and egg scenario that you talked about, that it's more likely that if you have the zoning settled, it enables the whatever is already broken to be fixed, and whether that's through roading upgrades or what NZTA we're talking about, which is some much more obviously comprehensive
Bus every five minutes.
Monorail, river. Yeah, who knows what we'll be looking at in that 20 years when things are, technology has changed so much in the last 20 years. Who knows what innovative solutions I'll have lined up for us.
I think the issue the NZTA will put into us is effectively it's already partly broken that you could make a really good job of it by approving all of the submissions, where it would be completely shattered. And they are submitting that we ought to stop significantly short of complete catastrophe. And what's the answer from your client's point of view?
It's not so much an issue for this client because we're not proposing any sort of significant rezoning. So it's not for this client. It's not something we've had to think too hard about.
That might be an answer to tomorrow's question, because when you've got a client who is seeking significant upzoning.
Yeah, that's right. So tomorrow, we call it significant, but tomorrow's tomorrow's one. It is a relevant question for tomorrow's client. So I think I'll defer that answer till tomorrow on that point. And then the last section, as we started with earlier on in the piece, I just go over those key RPS provisions and submit that what is required to give effect to those is less than what is notified. I think those submissions have been made to you before, so I didn't propose to go into them in any great detail.
questions of the State Government?
No, I'll wait for Mr. Ferguson.
We've got one page of summary from Mr. Ferguson.
Paragraph 63 of the evidence in chief, I propose the addition of three new policies within Chapter 6 relating to the management of landscape values within the Waikato Basin. I consider this important because of the way in which the Waikato Basin has been managed separately to the remainder of the Section 7 landscapes of the district. Now, I made a mistake in that evidence in chief, and in error, I listed the new policies as being 3.3.34, 3.5 and 3.6, whereas that should have referenced as policies 6.3.34, 3.5 and 3.6, which was alluded to in the preceding paragraph. Mr. Barr takes a view that such new policies are necessarily appropriate because they are addressed through Chapter 24. I consider that those policy additions are crucial to the understanding of the overall framework for the management of landscapes and as a foundation to underpin the structure of Chapter 24. The Council's position on the provisions relating to the retention of existing vegetation has not changed, and no new evidence has been produced that advances things. As a result, the opinions set out in my evidence in chief are unchanged. Mr. Barr accepts my suggestion for the an additional policy recognising established residential building platforms, and he suggests a new policy enabling residential development within building platforms created prior to 23 November 2017. I do not understand why Mr. Barr is suggesting that the policy is benchmarked to this date, given that the regime proposed through the Section 42A report seeks to enable building within building platforms approved through resource consent and as registered on the relevant computer freehold register as a permitted activity. The reason I prefer the wording of my policy. The rebuttal evidence for the Council reiterates its support for the rules within the Waikato Basin Zone in relation to height and setbacks from roads. And again, there's no new matters within this evidence to advance my understanding further, and I remain of the view that a maximum building height of 8 metres and road boundary setbacks of 20 metres in the lifestyle precinct are more appropriate. The rebuttal evidence by Mr. Langman and Ms. Gilbert remains opposed to the creation of a new subzone for Emmisfield. Their concerns relate to the creation of a micro-level zoning for a specific activity and compatibility with amenity interface with rural activities. Ms. Gilbert is also concerned that the effect of 25% building coverage through a controlled activity rule, potentially enabling a larger scale increase to building mass together with the potential for adverse landscape amenity effects. Reflecting on the rebuttal evidence for the Council, I agree that the rules could, without care, create a scale of buildings inappropriate for the area. Ms. Gilbert considers it necessary to consider such activity through at least restricted discretionary activity status, with a range of landscape focused criteria drawing from Stage 2 proposed district plan provisions. Accordingly, I support amending my suggested rule 24.4.30 to elevate the status from controlled to restricted discretionary and add in two matters of discretion for effects on landscape values and compatibility with community at the interface with rural areas and rural activities. The evidence for the Council continues to support the lifestyle precinct over the land at 64 Fitzpatrick Road, and there's no other evidence to respond to in this part of the zone. It's my summary statement. Now, some questions. First question,
Mr. Ferguson, might be one also for Council. We've received strong submission from at least one party that any additional Chapter 6 policies are out of scope, as not being on the variation. What is your or your Council's view of that point?
Scope question, I think I'll hand that over to Council.
Yeah, no, we're very live to that point, but consider that we submitted seeking those additional higher order policies because we saw that there was a gap in the integration top down if the Waipatipi Basin proceeded. So consider that because the Waipatipi Basin set up a certain framework without the higher level policies to properly vertically integrate it, it wasn't going to fit properly in the PDP, so I consider that the scope is there because the submission's been sorted and it's definitely sort of a consequential change to give it better integration in the proposed district plan framework.
Given the generality of your submission, are the natural justice issues, because, as I say, because you were, the submission you were supporting was so general, effectively saying a higher level framework with no details of what that framework should contain?
Right. Yes. Yes. No. I think any insertions into those higher level chapters would be in the strongest position in terms of scope if they were specific to the Waipatipu Basin land. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that there's no scope for a district-wide submission on seeking a new policy in Chapter 6 that is given rise to because of how the Waipatipu Basin maybe changes the general emphasis. But I think the safer position in terms of scope is that those higher order provisions integrate with the Waipatipu Basin specifically.
Now, Mr. Ferguson, in terms of your suggested amendment to the purpose of Chapter 24, you've taken issue with the word limited. Given a statement, this is a statement of purpose. Don't want to get too head up on it, but my immediate reaction was, well, aren't there standards and rules that constrain how broad the opportunity for subdivision is, starting with the minimum lot size?
Well, that's right. I mean, I guess the precinct is enabling an outcome to that standard. I don't think I've got any difficulty with the wording of that. I think that the way I read the wording was that the opportunity within the precinct is limited. And I'm making the point, I suppose, that there's a distinction between enabling of the development within the parameters that you provided for down to 6,000 square metres is a statement of fact almost, and the more limited proposition that you might then create new areas of precinct, which is perhaps a more limited subset of the overall zone. So having created the zone or the precinct, you are somewhat providing for that opportunity, and I didn't see it as being rules not being limited. So it's just a consistency thing, really. I mean,
my colleague, Commissioner Smith, has consistently asked a number of people whether the precinct is a de facto controlled activity so that consents are bound to be granted if the standards are are met. Is that your position?
Not quite. My understanding is that within the precinct that you're required to establish a residential building plan for.
No, I have it's Mr. Barr's suggestion.
Right. Well, then, if we were going back to the notified position, the notified position was discretionary, if I remember correctly. Was it fully discretionary for the identification? No, that was buildings, wasn't it? For subdivision, go back and have a look at the provisions. So under the notified provisions, the subdivision within the Wakatipi Basin Rural Amenity Zone and the Lifestyle Precinct were a restricted discretionary activity, and there is discretion over the location of building platforms, subdivision design and so on. And then quite extensive matters of assessment matters that were accompanied that. So I think the notified provisions provide some opportunity, a reasonable amount of discretion for council when it came at least to the location, the layout, and design of the subdivision.
About whether a subdivision should occur at all? Do you think that would be a legitimate exercise of discretion?
We'll look very carefully at the matters of discretion.
So, hypothetically, if a building couldn't be found in a suitable location could be found for a building, would it provide scope to decline it as a whole?
The assessment matters do talk about the extent to which the location of future buildings and ancillary elements, landscape treatment complements the existing landscape character, and then provides a list of matters to consider. The extent to which development maintains visibility values from public places, for example, neighbouring properties.
If the answer to those was badly.
Well, I think if the answer was it doesn't address, or the extent to which it would compromise those landscape values and this overall status as restricted discretionary activity, then in theory, I would think that would give the ability of the council to decline the consent.
Wouldn't that only occur if there was no mitigation option? Aren't all those things matters that are generally dealt with on high conditions? Visual effects on the neighbours.
It doesn't talk about, the matters of discretion are not limited in any way to just the position of the condition.
No,
and
they never are though, Ferguson. Practically, if you've lodged an application, you will suggest conditions to ensure that you satisfy all of those matters of discretion, won't you?
Or build them into the design, inherent into the design to
which avoid having to get. Which I think Commissioner Smith's been saying, you design it, you meet that, yes, ticked off.
Well, that's right, but what I'm saying is, I wouldn't make a presumption that was a tick off, for example, because there is many ways that those things could be interpreted by other people, by staff who are processing it, for example, might take a different view of what an important aspect of the amenity. community might be. So that could create tension within the process around the outcome. So I would not assume that it was a foregone conclusion, given the scope of the discretion and the assessment matters that we spend on that.
It does rely, obviously, on the administration of the rules and, you know, how they're dealt with by the council planners. But, yeah, I suppose the point that I had made it previously was that having the... Previously, we had a discretionary regime with a no minimum allotment size, so that the scope of the discretion was much broader, but by defining the minimum allotment average, or the average allotment sizes and the minimum lot sizes, you're sort of creating an expectation that they're the target.
I'd agree that the proposition is probably more targeted. I mean, the discretion that was available in the operative district plan, it's probably more relevant for those parts of, say, the precinct that might be new to the, you know, created from new areas of rural general, were pretty extensive. And there was the issue of cumulative effects, and the process came into that because there was a presumption that would be publicly notified. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the proposition under this is somewhat more narrow, but I still think that, you know, there is a threat in terms of the outcome and difference of opinion. There is a threat that it can be turned down, and that's the key difference in the status between, say, restricted discretionary and control activity. And there's a threat as to the ultimate outcome if people take a different view. It is somewhat narrower than what it used to be under the operative district plan.
And then potentially more so because of the LCU descriptions and the, you know, in many cases the LCUs have been taken in their entirety without sort of considering the more micro level capacity, you know, the location of buildings, the elevation, those sort of things. So.
Yeah, I mean, presumably the point of, and I mean, I support the having the character units as a more refined ways of understanding the values of the landscape. But presumably the point of doing that sort of thing is so that you can set yourself up with a more robust framework that when you're assessing some provisional development against those values, you've got a benchmark and you can say, well, you know, this area might be sensitive to absorption, and then coupled with your status, you've got something, your teeth, to do something about it.
Holding on, may I ask you to look at your suggested 24218 on page 19? The question I have for you is, given that there are a number of ONFs within the basin, whether the policy as you've suggested could be amended would adequately address potential effects on those ONFs?
I think the short answer is no, it would not do the job of protecting the values within the ONF. But I think we have other supporting policies that do that. I can reference those.
Are those the ones you suggested be placed in Chapter 6?
The ones that I've suggested being placed in Chapter 6 were more about...
Well, in that case, point out to me what you're referring to, please.
Doesn't seem to have been amended, 24215, requiring all buildings to be located and designed so as they do not compromise the qualities of adjacent or nearby outstanding natural features, outstanding natural landscapes, or of identified landscape features.
Question about the following one, 24251. Question I have is extension. Is putting it without any environmental test within the policy consistent with the objectives?
I think again the short answer is yes, but that's occurring with a suite of other policies that go with that. And I think what I think we were getting at is that that you've got a suite of policies that come under 24.2.1, which deal with your landscape visual energy values, protect, maintain, and enhance. And 24.2.1.3 deals with ensuring subdivision and development maintains and enhance, or protects, maintains, enhance, if you use the wording of Mr. Barr. The Wakatipi Basin landscape character and visual energy values identified for the landscape character units as described in section 24.8. I just didn't think there was a need to duplicate that outcome because you've got that covered in that policy.
Isn't it possible that the purpose of 24.251 is to give a policy basis for the locations the precinct applies to, and that it's directing the rural residential development going to areas of that nature, which gives you the basis for putting the precinct in place. And without that, you have no basis for where the precinct applies.
That's not how I read it, sorry.
Mm.
Not at all. That is a concern of mine, and it's one of the reasons.
Well, if you think about it the other way, if you take it out, then what basis do you have for determining if land should be appropriately zoned precinct?
Right. That's my 6.3.36, which I was suggesting putting into the...
You think that should go right at the top?
Well, I think you need it.
Within the zone.
Well, I think you need a basis for, in Chapter 6, we're saying, well, you've got a Section 7 landscape that applies throughout the district. Here's what that looks like, and that's, at the moment, a rural character landscape. And I think you need to set up in landscape terms how this proposition has been addressed through the Wakatipi Basin zone, and that seemingly is occurring through an alternative or different regime. So I think, well, my suggestion, my evidence is that it needs to be set up in a way that's included within chapter 6, which is the point of the policies that I was trying to load in for integration purposes. And the second part of that is that then you need to have some basis upon which you then identify that area, if you like, for landscape management purposes. So, yes, I think that's an important issue, but I don't think that policy does it, and I think there should be a policy in Chapter 6 that does do it.
Yeah, I think there is a policy in Chapter 5. I have to go and check. There's a policy in either 3 or 6 that does it in the other rural zones.
Yeah.
So that is true. But so I can understand now how you come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
That's fine.
79. talking about subservience to the landscape. The question I had for you is...
It's page 79.
Oh, no, paragraph 79. I believe you've got 79 pages.
That's true. Thank goodness.
Yes. The question I have for you is, if development is not subservient to natural landscape elements, does that mean it can't be absorbed in that landscape?
Well, I guess I was just trying to pick apart intention in the policy, and the start of the word in the policy is to provide for activity, so it's not overly restricted. So, you know, I'm not going to be particularly animated about it, but it's not an avoid or, you know, prevent or protect or anything like that. But it's talking about provide for activities that maintain a sense of openness and spaciousness on buildings in which buildings are subservient to natural landscape elements. And if you've identified areas, you know, it comes back to the earlier point, if you've identified areas within your Section 7 landscape that have got some ability, a greater ability to absorb development, because development within that area is going to be subservient, then is there a need to then apply a policy test for each development that goes within that, so within that precinct? And so I was just questioning, to what extent is it necessary? Does it add anything that's important to the consideration of building development within those parts of the landscape?
And the second question I have for you is, would it assist if the reference to spaciousness, openness and spaciousness was cross-referenced to the characteristics identified in Schedule 24.8?
Yes, potentially. That would be more accurate, I suppose.
Because effectively then you'd be saying, to the extent that they exist, as described in the schedule.
Yeah, I'm certainly saying. That could be another way of addressing it, or another way of addressing it is perhaps thinking of openness and spaciousness as a characteristic that, is it even possible to have in a precinct, for example? And is it, are you qualifying your spaciousness, openness to the Wakatuba Basin or Community Zone, which would be more capable of delivering such an outcome?
Okay, please, to your paragraph 97. What does policy of recognition do? What is the action, the course of action?
The verb. Well, the idea was that if we're looking at enabling of development within existing residential building platforms, then it's good practice to have the link in terms of the policies that go to the rules, and that at least it should recognise, but yes, so it could be to recognise and provide for, or would recognise and enable residential development.
So you don't need to provide for one.
Well, provide for development within, yes.
That might be what you're meaning, isn't it?
Well, you're trying to enable the development. I think the problem might have been
maybe the issue is just the way you've constructed it, and the second part should be the commencement. Naval building subject to achieving the appropriate standards on established building platforms. Is that what you really mean?
That would be probably a better way of giving it a more positive expression. I think I might have had in my mind that I was also thinking about this issue of historical residential burning platforms that have been created through the open industry plan. So it's probably thinking about that as being an issue that I think needs to be resolved and incorporated into the policy as well. But you know, that I think that type of wording of the enable first within the recognised within building platforms or established building platforms would get you there.
Yeah, I just want to make clear that Commissioner Robinson and I spent some time in stage one getting rid of recognised out of the policies.
All right.
Because it's a meaningless thing when you actually come to have an action. It's not something.
What is the relevant verb in the policy? Right. What is the action?
Point taken. Yes.
Go to paragraph 108, please. I quizzed Mr. Barr on this subject. I can understand the logic of moving from gross floor area to ground floor area. And I was asking him, why should you go from all buildings being there to any buildings and allowing the potential for multiple buildings to clutter up the site. So,
Commissioner Robinson has forgotten what I pointed out. There was an error in the in the text, as the decision's version of the text, which Mr. Bayer had copied for rural residential and rural lifestyle. Chapter 22, anyway, didn't agree with the recommendation report text, and it was it was one of those typos that slipped through the net, and he changed it to compensate for the typo.
So my question is there a good reason why it should be any rather than all that you can give me?
Well, the reason you've got a reasonable amount of protection with your restricted discretionary activity status for new buildings, I suppose, through the subdivision would develop through the subdivision process, and the establishment of any new building platforms have to go through a reasonably thorough test to arrive at an area for a building platform within which it's then permitted. And
but it's not in a building platform. I'm going to come back to that question. As notified, there's no requirement for there to be a building platform identified.
True. Well, yeah. In that case, if I suppose it's probably not as critical if it's, I had understood that the purpose of the rule was to put in place a trigger for the design of buildings over 500 square metres, and that anything over 500 square metres combined would have triggered that assessment. So now that you point it out, it would be seemingly so it would be internally more consistent to have it as all or any. But that's somewhat depends on the process by which you go about establishing, if you go about establishing building platforms.
Is it actually two different rules put together? And the building coverage of 15% should be separate from a 500 ground floor level on a building to trigger a design issue, because coverage has nothing to do with design. I think Mr. Barr may have suggested, but I can't recall that with much evidence.
So this standard applies anywhere within the zone, doesn't it? So this applies within the precinct and the rural emission zone. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I would certainly question their progress about 50% site coverage in the rural immunity zone. For a start.
Seems rather large.
It does seem rather large scale, really. Or, in fact, the need for that in the rural emission zone at all. But if your issue is more around the design of the buildings, then the 500 square metre limitation on the ground floor area would give you the ability to do that assessment. Struggle with the distinction, to be honest. In my mind, I probably think about it from a, oddly, but plan out thinking about the statute and how it tackles outstanding natural landscapes, which are prefaced with the protect. And it's referenced outstanding natural landscapes, which is always qualified, isn't it, by the development. So, strictly speaking, if you were to talk about maintenance, in my way of thinking, is about preserving, perhaps the status quo, and the preservation of the status quo could be seen as quite a different concept from protect, because I think this, when you protect, you're protecting something. Whereas maintenance is just a blanket, keeping the status quo. So I don't really find it particularly useful when you sort of think about the differences between maintain and protect. I think it's more about how the statute then deals with the qualifications that follow that. So for Section 6 landscapes, it's about the appropriateness or not of the subdivision use of development on the values of the landscape. And then again, it's the same sort of thing expressed in a slightly different way for Section 7, which again is just about a more general term of immunity values. I've tried to be quite clear, and so I'm turning out to Appendix 3 to my evidence. And paragraph E proposes to insert a new activity rule, 24.4.30. And that provides for, now, notwithstanding that we're looking at a status of restricted discretionary, but looking at the activities, I've tried to pin it down as much as possible through the commercial activities which are limited to conferences and events, exhibitions, the retail sales of farm and garden produce that are located within the precinct. And then separately, cafes and restaurants. So that anything outside of that would be then captured by the frame which exists in the chapter for commercial activities more generally, which, as a notification, I think commercial activities would generally not comply. So anything that sort of sits outside of that would be not compliant. Does that help answer the question in terms of the type of activities that you're thinking?
Thank you. I've wondered if there was maybe to base some direction about the scale or intensity of the activities as well.
Yeah, well, I guess this is the question that's been put by Ms. Gilbert around the scale of building at 25% site coverage and the status of that being controlling too, which I think is a fair point. I mean, it's not necessarily to enable in itself a large scale of building, which through the restricted discretion activity status and the additions to the matters of discretion, I think it would give you much greater guidance on managing the effects of the building development, the scale of the building development, and its impact on rural amenity values and landscape values.
And what's
dangerous territory.
Mainly
because I haven't really examined in any great detail the specifics of the capacity of each one of those wineries to accommodate any potential intensification or development on them.
If they were capable of doing that, the question is really, basis that if they were in the same way that you say that Emmisfield is, would it be an appropriate response to put each of them special recognition one way or another?
Well, I think it's to the degree to which they stack up in their own account, and so if we can just bring ourselves up a little bit in terms of the concept, if they're able to demonstrate that a level of activity is appropriate on the site, given the amenities, the layout of buildings, or its particular location, then conceptually, I wouldn't have any difficulty with putting a similar sort of framework in place for managing other activities. Which,
I mean, described to you as a reasonable consent application. Particular site, particular activity, framework of conditions.
Well, I mean, this is the policies. I mean, I guess the forum to address the long-term planning for these areas and thinking about putting in place parameters and standards for lots of different activities. It's an activity like anything else that's existing within the area.
Should we have less information at this stage to make something which cannot be refused consent, provided for, or make provision for something that can't be refused consent,
then we would have on the resource consent.
Well, I think, yeah, the point about the contradictory status is what I am reflecting on that. I agree with the council's evidence on that point, and I think that's probably appropriate to look at elevating that from control to restricted discretion so that it does give you the ability to turn it down in the event that those effects on landscape raw amenities can't be adequately managed on that within that subset. So I think
if we take that to the next logical conclusion, is there any reason why commercial activity shouldn't be discretionary to be within the precinct or the zone, the immunity zone?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is the, these are sort of the two sort of outcomes that are before us. I mean, at the moment, it was notified as a non-compliant activity and a reasonably strong stance. So I would readily acknowledge that there's more than one way to skin the cat in that respect. I mean, you could take a look through changes to the rural structure within the zone generally. That got you there. If you were satisfied that was an approach that could be dealt with across the zone. I guess what I had in my mind was looking at the specifics of this particular site and saying that's, in my assessment of how that evaluation of how it works against the policies of the plan, then it creates more certainty as to the outcome without affecting the rest of the zone. So I think I preferred the option of giving certainty through the creation of the subzone, rather than doing an approach which provided for an outcome potentially open across the work to be based on more amenities zone generally.
Another question I've asked Mr. Bauer in particular and some of the other planning witnesses is at section paragraph 100 you've talked about the rule 24.4 SA about identification of a residential building pattern. Can you tell me how this is a land use activity? So paragraph 100 you've stated that according to a report has a new rule for a restricted discretion of activity for residential building platforms. And you've gone on to state that these changes address two of the three issues raised in the submissions. And so my question is how is a residential building platform a land use activity? Mm-hmm. I understand when it's part of a subdivision.
Yes.
How can it be a standalone land use activity?
Right, okay. Well, might be perhaps a matter of exploring the mechanism by which you create the building platform. Is that a useful discussion in that context? It's quite important to actually understand what a building platform is, because I think different people have different meanings for that. And it's useful, I think, to have that understood in a very defined way. But I've always understood and encouraged clients to work towards, if it's a land use consent, the creation of a covenant plan, which then gets registered on the title, through a covenant. That's a section 108 covenant, it's my understanding, and it has attached to it a plan, and the conditions establish the parameters within the buildings can exist or development can exist within the residential building platform. So that gets registered on the title through a section 108 covenant. So the conditions on the covenant would prescribe that within area X, and area X is defined in the covenant plan, further restrictions on not enabling further urban development, and then within the covenant area you could have further conditions around maximum height of building or materiality or so on. And so that, I guess that talks about how it gets imposed as a land use mechanism, that does, so it doesn't involve subdivision.
My question really is land use consents lapse, if there's no activity and you've registered a piece of paper on the title of the covenant, what is the activity?
Well,
so when does it lapse?
Well, yeah, I guess that good question, because I've always thought about that. If you created a building platform and you didn't register your building platform on the title and the consent lapsed, if the purpose of the consent was to create the building platform through the registration of the covenant and the covenant plan, and you do that, you've given effect to the consent.
Well, no, what's the land use you've given effect to?
What's the use of land in section 9? That's all I've got. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's the... It's a residential activity in most cases, but yeah.
I think it's one pet question, so.
I think it's
a good question,
isn't it? Yes.
And so my next question is, well, if we were to decide that that's not the land use, what would you say the
law
framework should be, or would that change anything that you're asking?
Or could we have the answer to the first question?
Oh, okay.
First
question.
Yeah, this has got shades of plan change 19 and
not
comprehensive outline development plan. And the court determined that there had to be activity in terms of the trigger for the rule.
Mm.
So you can't have an activity status which is determined by a consent, is my understanding of that. So, yes, to unpick that. The approach that was adopted by the court in Plan Change 19 used a slightly different terminology of the Outline Development Plan, but if you substituted the words Outline Development Plan, they required consent for an activity, whether that was a residential activity, a commercial activity, whatever the activities were that were provided for by that particular zone. So you might, in the case of a residential building development, residential building platform, require consent for the residential activity. And then they said that the outline development plan was a piece of information that was required to be submitted with that activity. So it was an information requirement. So that's I think you're allowed under the Act to specify the information that you're required to submit with that activity for a consent. So there was a link to the provision. So it gave you the activity, and it gave you the information. And then the next rule was that the residential activity could not be undertaken in the absence of the resistance center proof. Under one that we've just talked about. And that gave you the framework that was the activity, the information required to submit with it, and things that weren't in accordance with it.
Well,
so
that would put you in a difficult situation with building platforms. That they would only give a 5-year consent, you wouldn't be able to register them.
So the activity
is the building. is the residential activity, not, and you've just information about where the building platform is.
Yes, well, you could register it, but you would have no benefit from registering it.
No.
That's
fine. And that was coming to the question that I was going to ask. Why bother with them? I can understand the purpose of making provisions for the existing building platforms, which have been from as a result of earlier decisions. But is there any need to continue with that in a zone which provides for residential activity as permitted? And buildings are restricted discretionary, but certain limitations and the bulk and location requirements.
The process of establishing the building platform provides certainty as the location to where that might go.
So does providing getting a consent for a building.
And it provided, once it's registered, of course, and assuming that it was biased to do so, it provided an ongoing right to entitlement or certainty of knowing that, that was able to happen.
To use Commissioner Smith's term, a commodity.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
And that, in fact, all that the council has done with the building platform rules has created a commodity market.
I wouldn't disagree. So how does one, can one, create an activity that is enduring? Without the actual physical building, I guess.
Do we need to? In resource management terms, the question is it necessary? Or is it just adding an extra layer of consenting that is unnecessary?
Yes. And then, what do you do with all the people who have legitimately gone through the consent process?
No, that's a different story. That you know, we understand that they have legitimately sought and obtained those consents. But it's the ones where they haven't. And there's all the land that was formerly rural residential anyway has been brought into the precinct where they didn't need to.
That's about the, you know, the concept of the building platform is quite unique to this district, really, and it doesn't seem to have life outside of Queenstown for whatever reason. Might be very good reasons, as it turns out.
The fact that it may have been invented by an environment for charges isn't even the only thing.
I couldn't even tell you how it was invented, really. But
I think it was one of the big decisions. I remember reading that, but it's a long time ago when I read it.
And the status of buildings would be, you know, as generally in other zones of the displacement, it's more prescribed as to the outcomes. There is certainty one way or the other of whether you can do that activity. And there's an entire industry that exists just off changing building platforms.
Well, that might be a second five matter before you put that in for
give an architect a building platform and it never fits for some reason. So that generates a whole lot of work to administer and for council and process and administration costs and transitions.
Commissioner Smith has experienced this.
Yeah. So, if you didn't have that mechanism in place and you were just relying potentially less onerous in terms of Section 32, less of transaction administration costs, so you can be argument made for that. I guess it's the question, the lingering question in my mind is the certainty of the outcome for people that have got, you know, like Hayes Limited and others that have got land where they've got development that's provided for down to a certain density, and an uncertainty of knowing what that outcome is. So we've got density, minimum allotment size, but a status which raises the uncertainty is whether that outcome is even possible. So I think that's kind of where it has particular focus around that certainty of the outcome. So if we talk about maybe the comparison between this and, say, a residential zone, for example, where you would have density, you would enable urban development, there would be a permanent activity subject to compliance with standards. And everybody knows that's what you can do, or there's a reasonable amount of certainty. But if you take away the security, if you like, of having a building platform and replace that with a regime where it's, you know, you've got your minimum allotment sizes, you've got your density requirements, but your status of building is still, I forget what it is under the 95 provisions, it was a restricted discretion, RT. Mm-hmm. So there's no real certainty as to the outcome either way. So you're not saying you can or you can't, and having reviewed, as we did on my very first question, there is some doubt as to the outcome, and I don't see that as being a checklist necessarily.
You don't see it being what, sorry?
Well, a checklist, it's not a foregone conclusion that if you submit an application under the restricted discretionary regime, you were going to be able to achieve the outcome which the density figures might otherwise lead you to believe that you could. So that has implications, obviously, for integrated planning with things like traffic and infrastructure and so on, because you don't, you know, neither the landowner nor the council knows what the, you know, what the certainty of that outcome is.
Yeah, I'll try and keep it brief. We're well and truly into dinner time.
So. Yeah.
just regard to the Lake Hayes cellar, sorry, I'm trying to think of the name, the Lake Hayes cellar. Given the history of that consent and that there was, as I understand it, there were a whole bunch of conditions imposed on particularly hours of operation and the types of activities in order to protect the amenity of neighbours, particularly, why wouldn't we rely on the consent rather than creating a new set of rules which essentially override all those protections for that were created under the consent?
Why wouldn't you? Well,
why wouldn't we rely on the consent? Yeah.
For an operational thing, such as an hours of operation, which is one of the, as a key outcome, it provides for the security of that outcome on an ongoing basis, and certainty for all those, both the owners and the community around it.
Doesn't the consent do that anyway?
Well, it does for the activity that was approved.
Yep.
It's just that that evolution and the change of that activity and the process to go through that and the uncertainty of what that outcome.
But isn't it then appropriate to assess the effect of that on those same neighbours that were protected by the original consent? If there are additional effects and additional
That's right. I mean, if you were to go through that process, that would be an appropriate outcome. Exactly.
Right.
But it's not trying to be hidden in here, because that's an open part of what the proposal was. It was part of the submission. And the hours of operation do change from 8 to 10, and that's an explicit outcome of the rezoning through the noise, changes to the noise provision. And part of that, I guess, has been through a public process, and the public have been included, the neighbours have been
You make the point in your evidence that the precinct covers a significant area.
The lifestyle precinct?
Yes, the precinct. Sorry, yeah, going on to different issues, sorry. That was 100 and... page 27, 112. Whilst I agree the overall extent of the lifestyle precinct could be seen as significant, make that comment. Am I to take from that that you get a sense from that it is quite a large zone, that it does cover quite a lot of land in the basin?
Yes, it is. Something like 700 hectares or something like that. The rebuttal evidence of Mr. Barr has a plan, and he quantifies the areas, and I did print that plan, I'm sorry. But I had in my mind it was...
1499.
1499, thank you. And I had with it some numbers around the additional capacity that creates and so on.
So we're told from him that a potentially 520 additional dwellings under those standards, and including the 75 metre setback. Now, it's your position that the average density and minimum size should go down to 4,000 square metres, and that the setback should be reduced to 20 metres. Is that correct?
I didn't say 4,000 square metres for density, no.
It's just the minimum lot size, is that right? That's 4,000.
You say the minimum lot size. I thought we were supporting that the 1 hectare average 6,000 square metre minimum.
I thought you had made a position that you wanted 4,000 square metre. Sorry, that's not correct.
I haven't addressed the... I have my evidence to you that doesn't address the minimum lot size for subdivision. It was just focused on the density outcome. And the density stuff, the density outcome I was supporting of the recommendations for Mr. Barr, which was to... Well...
The density on the 1 hectare, I think.
Yeah. But I was also saying that I think you need to create a mechanism in the density rule that recognised the ability to have a residential activity on either site, which addressed the problem of the inclusion of legacy areas and residential.
So what you're saying is that each site should have a minimum right of one?
Well, that's right. I mean, if you created the site and it addresses the problem of the rural residential zone, if indeed the rural residential zone is included, but then on, past that, then the density at an average of 1 and 6,000, I think was what I was supporting in my evidence.
And sorry,
I was supporting the 20 metre setback, but at paragraph 112. I think I might have been on a slightly different point there.
That's right, and I see your point further down that you talk about the 4,000 square metres, which is probably where I picked up that number from. So.
I see. Right.
So, just to confirm then, you support that density provision being 1 hectare average and a 6,000 square metre minimum?
Yes.
Now, your issue around road setbacks, and I use the example of Ladies Mile because it is an example where we do have an example of a 75 metre setback at the Queenstown Country Club. And just whether you seem to be concerned about the 75 metre setback, but just interested to whether it maintains a sense of openness when driving along public roads that we should be encouraging through this.
The Ladies Mile, as I understand, is not part of the moment, not
No, no, it's just the example of the 75 metre setback that at the country club, that is how far the buildings are set back from the ladies' mile road, yeah, the highway. So it's just
and
an example.
There might be some instances where there'll be parts of the basin where a greater setback might be desirable to address the values of the landscape, the landscape character unit descriptions under the schedule. I suppose that what I was trying to grapple with is that you've got a situation where you've had, particularly, and you know, this brings it into focus within your legacy areas of rural residential and rural lifestyle, you've had a pattern of development which has been undertaken and seemingly resulted in quite a number of houses that have conformed to a setback of 20 metres over, you know, quite...
Well, in fact, less than that in most cases, isn't a setback of 10 metres in rural residential?
Well, rural residential is less, but rural, rural lifestyle, it'll be 20, and rural general, it'll be 20. And I guess at a more pragmatic level, if you've got a pattern of development which conforms with that, and then you impose a new regime which is substantially different to that, how easy is that going to be, or how defensible is that framework going to be when you then come to administer those rules? So, you know, if somebody comes on to build a house and the neighbours both sides are something less than 75, what's the, how defendable is that regime? And so, you know, I have questions over that. Now,
isn't it an acknowledgement that that compression has already occurred and that you do need to protect the openness that remains?
Well, this is the tension, isn't it, where you've got a lifestyle precinct that seems to create areas of opportunity for new development in areas that were zoned rural, at the same time as providing for development in areas that were zoned rural residential and lifestyle. And that confluence of different zones does create quite a problem, I think. And that's one of the expressions of that problem, because I can point to examples where, you know, here, from the rural lifestyle zone, it wouldn't match what's there. But it might match if it was done in areas of the rural, of the lifestyle precinct that are reflective of old rural, for example. I think of areas like the Ladies' Mile or Hunter Road or areas like that. So there might be specific parts where that's addressed and covered. Where I sort of got to my evidence is that, well, I still think, you know, you're going to address that in your build, in your roles that, you know, that drive your building development, subdivision and building development roles, provided a restricted discretionary activity. And so that's your primary mechanism to deal with all of those setback, amenity, landscape interface issues. So if you've got that in place and it's a restricted discretionary activity and you've got a reasonably explicit set of criteria, why do you need to then have 75 square metres when such examples are incongruous with reasonable areas in the precinct? Because you've already got your backstop in place.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. I think we can finish
up there. Thank you. I think we've got one more. Just in your noise standards that you've proposed, Mr. Ferguson, for the precinct. How do you apply? How do you see them applying? I'm just interested that you're suggesting that non-compliance is a restricted discretionary activity with no matters of discretion, but even ignoring that point. How do you apply noise limits when it's restricted discretionary to go beyond them?
I didn't bring chapter 36 with me, I'm sorry.
But I'm pretty certain, being the author of that book, that non-compliance is non-compliant throughout for the standards.
There's a head that's shown where you've got table 2, 36 by 4, immediately above.
Well, at the time of putting together either the submission, or both the submission and at least the submission, I'm fairly sure there were provisions that provided for noise, non-compliance as a restricted discretionary activity. It may well have been reflective of the position as 36 and 35. So
I think by the time we got to the through the hearings, it was acceptance that administrative difficulty with making the prospective discretionary.
Okay.
So from your point of view, it's the standards.
Well, it's the standard or the hours of the daylight and the nighttime hours that are the important aspect of the change.
Important issues as far as you're
concerned. It's the
evening, 2 in the evening.
Exactly.
Okay.
Can I just put on one more question?
Yes.
Going back to the objectives and policies again for the Lakehead cellar, I can clarify now what I was trying to ask you earlier. The objectives and policies just talk about commercial activities and they don't narrow them down, so I accept what you're saying with the rules, but if you're looking for that vertical integration, it's not there, and so if you weren't one of those activities on the table, and then I was trying to use the objectives and policies to guide me, I wouldn't know what kind of commercial activity it should be, because it's wide open.
Yes, and I accept that as the case, and take the point, and it would probably be appropriate if that was the case, the policy should be refined in the same way as the wide.
Okay, thank you.
I've just looked up chapter 36, the decision version, and all but one, it's not complying to breach the noise limit.
The one is the airport,
and so just noting that Mr. Ferguson's words about discretion is restricted to is that mirrors that frame.
And there were no submissions on that one.
Right.
Interesting. I knew I got it from somewhere, but I thought it might have been the notification.
I wasn't sure of the bearings of that rule anyway, but there was no submissions.
There was.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.